redrawing district maps, more money for the Everglades, and saving history from destruction. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Lawmakers are redrawing the district maps for state offices and Congress. It's a process done every 10 years. The party in power usually gets to redraw these maps to their advantage. But something uniquely different is happening in Tallahassee this year. Also, Biden has promised more than $1 billion to Everglades restoration efforts. What will that money go toward? And is it enough? And finally, a piece of history is rescued.
Those maps almost became wrapping paper. Had it not been for this chain of events of just the right people finding them at the right time.
The blueprints of the Henry Flagler Railroad were found in someone's attic. We'll tell you the harrowing story. All of that today on Sundial after the news. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thank you so much for joining us. Congressional maps are redrawn every 10 years, and this happens to be one of those years. The Florida legislature is drawing and redrawing maps as we speak. New maps are supposed to make it so that populations are accurately represented in elections. Parties use this process to strengthen their political power for the next decade, at least. Well, joining us now is Politico Florida's Bureau Chief, Matt Dixon. Matt, great to have you back.
Thanks for having me.
So it's once every 10 years. Here we are. And remind us, how is this supposed to work?
That's right. I'm starting to feel old. This is my second Florida redistricting process, but it comes around with all the new census data. And as you had talked about, it's to readjust the state's political lines from county commissions all the way up to the state legislature and congressional maps with population changes. And generally, the way it works is it's a process pretty driven by the legislature, the House and the Senate, like any bills. When they redraw these maps, they are functionally pieces of legislation. So the House passes a bill, the Senate passes a bill, they have to reconcile differences. And then the congressional maps go to Governor DeSantis or whomever the governor is at the time. And the governor can veto or sign the congressional maps. But the state legislative maps, the maps for the state House and the state Senate, go right to the courts for approval. So there's a bit of a difference in how the maps are treated. But that's kind of the general outline for how redistricting traditionally works in Florida.
And again, it's supposed to, again, help populations accurately redrawing those maps so the populations accurately are represented. But whoever's in power really has a lot of sway over those maps, right?
Yeah, they really do. There's anti-gerrymandering provisions in the state constitution called fair districts that are supposed to blunt some of that. And they do work to a degree here in Florida if you compare Florida's process to other states. But certainly, you know, those who hold the map drawing pens wield a lot of power. And in this case, it's staff largely and attorneys hired by Republican majorities in the state legislature. So there's, you know, I think arguments can be made on both sides here in Florida because, you know, gerrymandering is prohibited in the Constitution, that, you know, the process is generally fair. But I think even Democrats who are minorities here in Tallahassee would say that, you know, they'd much rather have those pens in their hands.
And look, I mean, it's been around a long time, but, you know, remind us again, gerrymandering, it's always a highly debated issue.
Yeah, and it used to be the gerrymandering or the idea of the political party in the majority sort of picking their own districts to maintain political power. That's kind of what that term means. And it used to be much worse in Florida. The lawmakers in recent years, since the passage of these redistricting constitutional amendments, talk about the olden days where the redistricting room is in the Republican Party of Florida headquarters in Tallahassee, and basically members would just come in and pick their own districts. Those days do not exist anymore in Florida. That I can assure you is gone. But there's still certainly, to your point, power with you know, being the party that gets to draw the maps.
All right. So where are we right now in the redistricting of maps? At this point, the Senate's got theirs. They've got a couple. The House has a couple. But where are they in the process?
The Senate is moving a bit faster. The Senate has picked its preferred congressional and Florida Senate maps. So those are both have been passed by the full chamber. The Senate is sort of done with their piece. As a side note, both chambers are responsible for drawing their own maps. So the Florida House will draw the House maps, excuse me, and the Florida Senate will draw the Senate maps. So the Senate for now is kind of in a waiting game. It's done its work, passed its drafts, and now all eyes are kind of turning to the Florida House, which has moved forward a draft proposal of the state house maps, but notably has not really signaled where it's going to go for, on its congressional map. So a lot of people are looking to the Florida House right now to get some sort of signal on how it envisions the congressional maps looking for the next 10 years. And right now that's kind of the biggest question mark, or certainly the biggest piece of intrigue as we watch the state level redistricting process.
Let's take a look at the Senate maps. There's been some criticism from Democrats on the Hispanic population not being fully represented. What are they claiming?
Well, what they have claimed in the quote that has come up time and time again from sort of advocacy groups during committee meetings where these maps were discussed is Latino political power is being diluted. And it sort of depends on how you look at it. I don't know that it's necessarily black and white. The Florida Constitution requires that some seats be protected for racial and language minorities. And that means having seats that where Hispanic voters can reliably elect a candidate of their choosing, and also Black voters can reliably elect a candidate of their choosing in those districts. And right now on the current maps, as we stand today, there are four congressional seats that fit that description. The Senate is proposing to do four again. The Senate draft would keep the number the same. And what some organizations have argued is that Hispanic population is increasing, so therefore there should be an additional seat. And they're saying because there isn't an additional seat, that is gonna disadvantage Hispanic voters in the state. And because there's so many ways to draw a map, it's difficult to come up with a black and white answer. It's often shades of gray with this stuff. Right. But that's their underlying argument. Hispanic population has increased, therefore there should be another seat that reliably performs for Hispanic voters.
And something interesting happened, with a Senate map. There was an amendment proposed and agreed upon. That amendment was from Democratic State Senator Chevron Jones. What did he want to amend, and why did they agree to it?
Well, it is rare, honestly, to see a Democratic amendment be accepted by a Republican-led Senate. So there was an odd bit of bipartisanship. And essentially what it did was kept Miami Gardens whole. Miami Gardens, that the city was split between two districts. Chevron Jones, who represents that city in the state Senate, filed an amendment that would keep it in, I believe, Congressional District 24, which is represented by Democrat Frederica Wilson. So that's essentially the only tweak that it made. Miami Gardens was split, and now it is all in one congressional district based on the Senate draft maps that are out there floating around today.
Again, I'm talking with Politico Florida's Bureau Chief Matt Dixon, talking about Florida's redistricting process, which started when the legislature started. It happens every 10 years. The Florida legislature draws these new maps, again, from your local to your state to congressional maps. And, you know, we've seen in the past controversies. Sometimes these have to go to court. But where are they now in that process? You could always follow that story and anything that's going on in the legislature on our website, WLRN.org. Something else that happened that never happened, Matt. The governor proposed a congressional map. That's never been done in Florida, right?
Certainly not recent memory. We can't find an example in certainly like modern day Florida politics. So it's very rare and sort of was unexpected and sort of shook the political system a bit. So the governor, he's not trying to chime in on the state house or the state Senate maps, but you're right. I believe a week ago, his general counsel, his office's top attorney, submitted a redrawn congressional map sort of outlining the governor's vision for things, which is certainly not the norm for the governor to get involved in something like this.
And is his map that much different than what we're seeing?
Yeah, I mean, it's seen as a signal. The Senate map there's 28 total congressional districts. The Senate map, on the Senate map, President Trump or former President Trump would have won 16 seats based on 2022 election. So he would have won 16 of the 28, so well over half. But a lot of national Republicans, and there was some conservative pushback. They were saying, well, Florida has a Republican House, a Republican Senate, a Republican governor. They wanted more aggressive maps. And there were groups kind of actively and very publicly lobbying, saying the Florida Senate's not aggressive enough. We don't like those maps. Governor DeSantis put forward a map that would have, I believe, give President Trump at the time in 2020, would have given him 18 seats as opposed to 16. So it's seen as a more aggressive map for Republicans. And I think a lot of people viewed it as a signal from the governor's office to some of those outside conservative critics saying, hey, I'm with you. We're going to try to push for a more aggressive map for Republicans. And that's certainly what it is.
And you spoke with, talking about Chevron Jones earlier, you spoke with him about the governor's map. What did he say about it?
Yeah, a lot of Democrats, because it would cut the number of seats. I had mentioned earlier that there's constitutionally there has to be seats that allow Black and Hispanic voters to reliably pick a candidate of their choosing. And this one would cut the number of Black seats from 4 to 2. So Chevron Jones, he said, this is a direct quote, "This map is not only unconstitutional, but it dilutes Black reputation in Florida. To add insult to injury, the governor submitted to this map, all while tweeting a quote honoring Dr. King." He released this map on MLK Day, so that also got a lot of attention from some African-American members of the legislature. So there's definitely some heavy-duty Democratic pushback to the governor's plan, and it actually should be noted, I didn't bring this up earlier, the Senate maps have largely gotten bipartisan praise, I think because a lot of Democrats don't see them as an aggressive Republican gerrymander. It passed the 40-member state Senate. Both maps the Senate has put forward got over 30 votes. So there's plenty of Democrats who are in support of what the Republican majorities have done in the Senate. There are no Democrats who are in favor of what Governor DeSantis is proposing.
And, you know, that's interesting because when we talk about, like, what happened 10 years ago, and the Republicans were in charge then, but the redistricting maps ended up in court. Remind us of what happened then.
Yeah, there was a 4-year legal process, actually, after the 2012 redistricting process. And basically, the courts found that essentially Republican consultants kind of had a shadow campaign to draw the maps behind the scene and submit maps for public consideration without sort of being transparent where they were coming from. As a result, the current maps, the maps that sit today, were essentially drawn by voter groups that challenged the state Senate and the congressional maps. The Florida Supreme Court, after a lengthy years-long legal challenge, sided with the proponents who said that there was illegal level, or excuse me, the plaintiffs who said there was illegal levels of gerrymandering, and adopted their maps. So the maps we sit on today were essentially drawn by outside voter groups, and the legislature is taking pains to sort of avoid that process this year, or at least they have it so far.
And I mean, look, there was an amendment in 2010, you know, for more transparency. Is there the transparency we hope there would be?
I don't know if it's been more transparent, because there's one of the byproducts of this is everyone is so concerned about lawsuits that nobody can really talk much about it. And especially with, like, getting when we interview lawmakers after committee meetings, they don't really say much because they're all afraid of being deposed. So there's certainly additional layers of legal scrutiny. I do think to a degree those amendments are working because they're, you know, everyone is so cognizant and so aware of the specter of lengthy legal challenges and nobody wants that. So I do think they're working, but I'm not sure if it added additional transparency to the process or not. It's just more legal scrutiny and sort of, you know, shocked the system and scared everyone. And this year, particularly because of the pandemic, a lot of the census data was released late. So there wasn't public hearings across the state like there was in 2012. In 2012, there was meetings in every corner of the state where lawmakers went and talked to members of the community about what they want for their political lines. That didn't happen this year. Some advocates absolutely wanted it. Republican majority said, well, we didn't have time. So I don't know if transparency is the right term, but there's certainly additional legal scrutiny and everyone is very aware that lawsuits likely loom.
Do we expect legal battles after these maps are drawn this time around?
Yeah, the sky is blue and redistricting brings legal challenges. It's just how it works. So, yeah, I fully expect there to be legal challenges. It's just there will be lawsuits, but how those lawsuits are written are going to be based on which maps are selected. If the governor's map, which is seen as sort of a more aggressive draw for Republicans, is picked, I think that will be the focus. If they do go with a Senate map, like the congressional map I had mentioned had bipartisan support and is seen as not an aggressive draw for Republicans, I think they will find, they'll focus on some of the Hispanic access seats that we spoke about earlier. So I think no matter which way the legislature goes, there's going to be legal challenges. That's just part of the process. But the severity and the seriousness, seriousness is probably the wrong term, but the way the legal challenges are framed are going to be based on which maps are passed.
All right. Again, talking with Politico Florida's Bureau Chief Matt Dixon. Find more of his reporting and also just follow the process again on the redistricting maps on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Matt, always a pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Still to come, President Biden has promised more than $1 billion for Everglades restoration. Is it enough? Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. The Biden administration recently announced a plan to help restore the Everglades. It includes $1.1 billion in spending money for things like filling in canals, restoring original water flows, and saving the wildlife that lives there. Is that enough money? Are the Everglades even safeable at this point? Joining us now is Eve Samples, the executive director of Friends of the Everglades. Eve, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
$1 billion from the Biden administration. When you heard that, what was your initial reaction?
Absolutely pleased with the appropriation. But in a nutshell, funding even of this magnitude is not enough. And I think we have to zoom out a little bit to think about what this $1 billion means. So Congress approved the Comprehensive Everglades Restoration Plan 22 years ago at a cost then of $8 billion. And since then, estimates for all of these projects has increased to $23 billion. So while $1 billion is certainly significant, it's not enough to get this entire suite of 68 projects done. And then, of course, we have to talk about water quality, which is a whole other part of the story that SERP does not address.
And, I mean, the White House saying this is, you know, the largest investment in the Everglades ever. I mean, it doesn't sound like that's enough. But, I mean, is it really the biggest investment they've made so far?
Yeah, so this is from infrastructure funding, right? So it's in addition to about $350 million in an annual appropriation that is tagged for Everglades restoration. So it absolutely is the largest single allocation of funding for Everglades restoration projects in recent years. So it's going to go toward a whole suite of projects, including what's known as the BBCR project, which is an effort to restore Biscayne Bay, also some reservoir projects up in the Northern Indian River Lagoon, Broward County infrastructure. And as I said, SERP, the Comprehensive Everglades Restoration Plan, which Bill Clinton signed in 2000, includes 68 projects. This is a handful of them, and this $1 billion will get them across the finish line, but there will be many more outstanding to restore the remnants of the greater Everglades.
Let's talk about, you know, the understanding Everglades restoration and what it looks like. And I want to just first, you know, point out the reality of the Everglades. Let's remind ourselves that over many decades, we destroyed about half of the system with farms and development. Is that fair to say?
Yes. So we drained the Everglades due to development pressure and also to create the very large Everglades agricultural area, which is south of Lake Okeechobee. About 400,000 acres of sugarcane are there today still.
All right. So over the decades, I mean, I've been covering this story for about 10 years now, but I know it's been going on for a while, and we've had governors and the federal government promising investment into restoration. Why has this battle gone on this long?
Well, we, mankind, replumbed the system in a way that was very detrimental, not just to the ecosystem and its inhabitants in terms of species, but also to the water supply for human beings who depend on South Florida. And I think it's a massive undertaking to return it to some semblance of what Mother Nature created. But it's worth doing because all of our futures depend on it in Florida. We've seen in recent years toxic algae blooms. We know that the public health threat is greater than ever, not only due to pollutants that cause those toxic algae blooms, but also increased pressure due to sea level rise and our water supply and the aquifer. So there are a lot of good reasons to keep pushing ahead to do this, even though it's extremely daunting. And these massive dirt moving projects are a big part of Everglades restoration, absolutely, those 68 projects where we're essentially replumbing the Everglades. But I have to say, these won't be successful on their own unless we also work to impose stringent water quality standards in Florida. The state of Florida is repeatedly missing pollution targets across the state. We've got to make sure that we're also adhering to or implementing really pollution limits so that these infrastructure investments are not undercut.
You know, listening to you, you know, you describing it as daunting, it's very fair to say that we've got all these projects we need to do in order to try to reassemble what Mother Nature did over millions of years. But this $1 billion is only going to pay for, as you said, a handful. Is that enough moving forward? Or, you know, can you, you know, in piecemeal, put it back together? Or do we have to have a more aggressive approach?
So I do think that the comprehensive Everglades restoration plan, as mapped out 20 years, is a good, solid plan. And we will need to implement pieces of it as the funding comes in. And $1 billion is a nice bump for sure. And individually, each of those projects can deliver some relief. For instance, the very first one of those 68 projects, the first infrastructure project, is a reservoir up in Martin County, the C44 Reservoir. It was just completed. And that actually will capture some of the local runoff that goes into the St. Lucie Canal so that it's not flowing into the St. Lucie River and contributing to toxic algae blooms and the pollution that spawns those. So while all of these 68 projects were designed to work together, they also do have individual benefits. So yes, we need to continue funding it. We need more funding, but we also have to be really aggressive in terms of not letting the Florida legislature undercut pollution regulations that we know we need. We can't spend billions of dollars building these giant reservoirs and new canals and stormwater treatment areas while we're adding additional pollution into our waterways. That just doesn't make sense. And I'll add to, development, smart development is a big part of this picture. Right now, for instance, not far from Biscayne Bay in Homestead, there's a proposal to convert about 800 acres of green space, current farmland, into 9 million square feet of industrial development. So that sits between two national parks. It sits in the footprint of Everglades restoration, the BBC or Biscayne Bay project. So we need to be smart about protecting this massive federal investment, even as we're continuing to implement it.
Again, talking with Eve Samples, the executive director of Friends of the Everglades. And as we mentioned, the Biden administration promising $1.1 billion from the infrastructure bill to help in Everglades restoration. Again, most of the plan calls for things like removing levees, filling in canals, storing fresh water. Certain projects, of the many projects that are out there in the restoration plan, this will only cover a handful or so. You can learn more about this money and what it's for and what it's supposed to do on our website, WLRN.org. Eve, this, it's really interesting to talk about development. And I thought I would want to touch on it for briefly, but it seems like really this plays such a big part. And I know that right now there's been debate for a while, slowly encroaching on, the border between, South Florida and the Everglades. And that keeps getting pushed further and further, that boundary. Smart, when you talk about smart expansion of development, how? Florida's just growing and people keep moving here. And that pressure is always going to be there because it's a lot of money.
Right. So I will say there's a simple answer to that question. It is implementing the rules we have on the books. So in Miami-Dade County, there are actually really good rules on the books to protect the urban development boundary And it's a matter of county commissioners adhering to those rules. So I mentioned the 800-acre proposal in the Homestead area. This is for a what's being called a logistics center that would serve Amazon as a distribution facility. And currently that land is zoned for agriculture. It's deemed coastal high hazard area, which means it's some of the least suitable land for development in the county. So let's adhere to those rules on the books rather than trying to make development easier. And that's for the benefit of a select few, the developers who stand to make money off the project at the expense of those of us who will pay for the added infrastructure, the added flooding costs, not to mention the added pollution in Biscayne Bay. That area in particular is sandwiched between two national parks, Biscayne National Park and Everglades National Park. And it's really critical to protect what we do have left since we've already lost so much of it in Florida.
You know, we've had so many governors who've made a lot of promises. Wanted to get your take on the DeSantis administration and its handling of this issue. And from what I'm hearing, that a lot of the challenge you have is, again, it comes back to pollution. It's really, you know, one of the big challenges in trying to get this governor and lawmakers in Tallahassee to move in the right direction. Is that what you're saying, basically? Is that the biggest issue you have with them?
So Governor DeSantis came out the gate very strong after he was elected in early 2019. In his first weeks on the job, he rolled out an environmental executive order. He called for more Everglades funding. And what we see the need for now at Friends of the Everglades is follow through on a lot of those points of order. So, for instance, one of the things Governor DeSantis did was create a blue-green algae task force. And that task force has some brilliant minds on it from FIU and other universities. And this task force came up with recommendations for limiting pollution that causes these toxic algae blooms in Florida. And unfortunately, a lot of those recommendations have not been acted upon. So we see the need for more follow through. Yes, funding has been there both from the state and federal governments, and we're fortunate to be in a position now where funding is pretty flush at both levels. But we've got to have the enforcement of existing rules, and we have to not erode our rules further. And unfortunately, legislative sessions going on in Tallahassee right now, there are proposals to do just that, including a bill that would loosen regulations on fertilizer application. So we do have concerns about that.
You know, one of the interesting things is that you had spent quite a bit of time in your career as a journalist covering environmental issues and now leading Friends of the Everglades. I'm wondering, you know, what were some of the frustrations that you experienced as a reporter covering those issues, and are they similar to what you're dealing with now?
Yes. So, we were founded by Marjorie Stoneman Douglas, Friends of the Everglades was in 1969. And of course, she got her start as a journalist too. And I think when you cover these issues as a journalist, and you can probably relate to this, the injustice of it just really can resonate with you. So I know I got to a point in my career after 20 years where I wanted to be working on the side of folks who are trying to fix the problems. And that's what we try to do at Friends of the Everglades. So yeah, it does bring a very interesting perspective to the work. And I think too, once Floridians have a good understanding of some of these issues, which can be very complex, there's a real intuitive sense of what's right and what's wrong. And that's what we saw in the 2018 election, actually, when we had green waterways, toxic algae blooms in parts of Florida. Floridians, voters saw that, understood it, and it became one of the biggest election issues in the governor's race that year. So I think keeping the spotlight on these problems, making them understandable, is really important. So the money is one thing, as I said, and I know that's the crux of what we're talking about today, but following through on enforcement and keeping the spotlight on, even when our water looks pretty good and we don't have fish kills in Biscayne Bay, that's important to remember that it can happen again.
You know, I mean, considering we have all these issues that we're trying to take on, trying to handle right now, we are also dealing with the issues of the climate crisis. And I'm wondering if, you know, you could keep the topic of restoration top of mind for people when they are being bombarded with the fact that, you know, sea level rise may be surpassing, you know, our efforts to be able to restore the Everglades at this point.
Right. It's really important not to let that overshadow the need for restoration. It can feel futile, I think, if you solely focus on sea level rise projections. But in reality, the whole crux of Everglades restoration is about moving water south from Lake Okeechobee, clean water, down to the Everglades, the National Park, and Florida Bay. And that same effort also will help hold back saltwater intrusion. It addresses some of the sea level rise concerns. It can help protect our water supply in the aquifer. So there's very good reason to accelerate Everglades restoration due to the added pressure of sea level rise.
You know, it's not something I've seen that often, but look, I learned a lot about the Everglades in part because I grew up in it or near it. But I'm wondering, you know, are there enough efforts, should there be more efforts in public education about these issues? Maybe bigger campaigns. Is that necessary?
Absolutely. In fact, that's a big part of what we focus on at Friends of the Everglades is publicly communicating about Everglades restoration, the benefits of the Everglades in layman's terms. And you don't have to be out in the Everglades every day to appreciate their value. Maybe you care more about your water supply. Maybe you kayak on Biscayne Bay. There are many different reasons to appreciate the Everglades. And when I say Everglades, I'm talking greater Everglades, starting up north of Lake Okeechobee, the headwaters are up in Orlando, out east and west from Okeechobee, Stewart, Fort Myers, down to Miami and the Florida Keys. So really the Everglades, as we talk about them, encompasses half of Florida. So when we think about it that way and we educate people about it that way, I really think that everyone realizes they have a personal investment in their future.
Again, as Florida continues growing, you know, what makes you hopeful that we can restore the Everglades?
Absolutely, the response we get from people once they understand the problem. For instance, right now, the Army Corps of Engineers is working on a new plan for managing water in and out of Lake Okeechobee. It will take place late this year and take effect for 10 years. So we've been communicating with Floridians about the stakes in terms of how that water moves, how moving it better in better ways can prevent toxic algae blooms. And once we get that message out there, we see a lot of response. In fact, we had an email go out today to the commanding officer for the Army Corps of Engineers, and a lot of folks are sending those messages. So that gives me great hope. When we band together, we as Floridians who care about the future of our environment can be so much more effective, and we can have a chance against really powerful political interests that have lobbyists influencing legislation and companies that make really large political donations. But we have people power, and that does give me hope.
Eve Samples, the Executive Director of Friends of the Everglades. Eve, I really appreciate the time. Thank you for the conversation.
Thank you.
And again, you can follow more of this story and that $1 billion on our website, WLRN.org. Still to come, someone found the original blueprints for Henry Flagler's railway to Key West. We'll hear all about that coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Do you know what's in your attic? Because there could be treasure up there. Now, that's what happened when someone found a series of rolled-up pages a few years ago, and they almost tossed them out. But they took the pages to someone who later found, hey, these are important. It turns out those rolled-up pages were the original blueprints of Henry Flagler's railroad to Key West. Now, for January, we've been reading Last Train to Paradise by Les Standiford, the story of Flagler's effort to build that railway to Key West. Those pages are now in the special collection at the University of Miami. Earlier today, we spoke with Christina Favretto, head of special collections at the university. How would you describe the collection of blueprints from Henry Flagler? My understanding is it's like, what, 12, 13 rolls of drawings?
It was 10 rolls of drawings and of various sizes, the largest being the map charting the development of the railroad from pretty much Homestead to Key West. And that was about 10 feet long. very fragile.
So the is it one roll that's 10 feet long, or are all the
one
rolls...
roll was 10 feet long?
Wow.
Yes. And there were other smaller blueprints. One of them was even of the fireplace in William Crome's home. So they were varied. But the story behind them is very interesting, of how they were found.
Well, but before we get to that part of the story, yeah. what makes these blueprints significant?
Well, even though they're not unique, not all of them, what's unique is what makes them significant is that they're tangible evidence of a big project, of a big collaboration of Miami's history. And there's something about, you know, we can see the digitized materials, but there's something about touching the actual fabric they're made out of, because they're paper backed on cloth, that really kind of brings you back. It's like, if you're reading Proust, it's like the Madeleine, you know? It's what sparks off so many other memories, questions, and stories.
What kind of condition were they in when you got them?
They were not in good condition. This is South Florida. Even in the best circumstances, paper doesn't fare well usually, unless it's kept in an environment like ours. So they were cracking. They had mildew and possibly other pests. They were torn, flaking. Blueprints are very, very fragile to begin with. It's just a medium that doesn't last very long unless it's preserved and conserved by professionals.
And you had to go through a process of conserving them first. What's that process like? And I'm wondering, like, how long it takes.
The process can take a very long time. It's very exacting. Folks who are preservation librarians and conservators, they have a very zen job in that what they do takes a long time. You know, you have to go through certain steps, and you have to complete one step before you can go to the other one. You can't jump ahead. So there has to be first a freezing process for about 72 hours so that you can get rid of pests, insects, larvae, etc. Then you have to introduce humidity so that you can flatten the object so that you can start working on it. Because if something's been rolled up for a long time, we've all experienced this, it wants to stay rolled up. Paper is a creature of habit in a way. So it's rolled, it's very hard to unroll and keep flat. So there's that. And then comes the process of looking at all the little tears. The conservators, who were Duvi Argandona and Laura Fidnitsen, they used a special kind of eraser that's very crumbly to gently erase all the markings, the dirt that had accumulated over the years. And then they started doing the mending with Japanese paper, where you literally pull together the fibers of the paper and reattach them to one another. I've seen them work on correspondence, letters that were crumbled. They were just like flakes, and put them back together. It's an amazing job. It takes a very steady hand, a lot of patience, and a lot of skill, knowledge of chemistry, etc. So it's a long process. And then you go to the process of digitizing these materials, but first the conservation work has to be done.
Yeah. I mean, first of all, where were those maps before you got your hands on them?
This is the very interesting part of the story. And those maps were in an attic, and those maps almost became wrapping paper. Had it not been for this chain of events of just the right people finding them at the right time. So the maps were in the attic of the Crome homestead. There, William Crome, the engineer who Flagler hired to plan the execution of that leg of the railroad, someone had put them in the attic, where they stayed together with clothes and old National Geographics and seashells, etc. And the house was going to be sold. And the person living there at the time, who was the ex-husband of Crome's great-granddaughter, was cleaning it out, and he saw what he thought was wallpaper. And he knew he had a friend, a person who was his yoga instructor, actually, who made wrapping paper out of old wallpaper. So I said, this is a great gift for her. And brought it to the yoga class. And the person knew that this was maybe something special. So her good friend, a person she regularly made guava jelly with, and I've had some of that delicious guava jelly, who happened to be an English lecturer and instructor at the University of Miami, looked at them and thought, you know, I think these are blueprints and I think they may be important. So she contacted our head of you think blueprints and you think architecture, right? So she contacted our head of the architecture library, and Gilda Santana looked at them and said, I think they're important. So she contacted Special Collections, and then it kind of snowballed. We brought in the preservation people. And but something like that, it's a big undertaking. It's very expensive to do the preservation and the digitization because it has to be outsourced. When something is 10 feet long, we don't have the equipment here, unfortunately, in our labs to do something like that. So it just so happened that there were grants available at the time called CREATE grants that allowed for collaborations between faculty and departments of the library. So it was a perfect fit. So, you know, it was like pieces of a puzzle fitting together. And then at the end, you have these incredible maps.
I want to come back, though, Christina. I'm still just floored at this story. And what goes through your mind when you think about the fact that they were just sitting there rolled up next to some magazines and seashells? And at one point, somebody thought of using it as wrapping paper. Mm-hmm. What do you think about when you hear that?
You know, it always surprises me, but I've been doing this for a long time. And I have to say, it doesn't surprise me because we think of all the things that probably have disappeared. Had it not been for people who love history, people who recognize that they're looking at something important. You know, when I think about materials disappearing, I think of something like the Library of at Alexandria. That's gone. We don't know what we lost. Perhaps we lost some of the greatest literary works in history. We don't know. So what we don't know doesn't really bother us that much. But when we realize what a close call some of these materials are, then we know to be careful about our historical record. And I deal with people all the time who are looking at estates of maybe their grandparents, and they're cleaning out an attic and saying, oh, this could be important or it couldn't be. And
right.
I would say that maybe 10% of people know to even go to look at their local historical associations, whether it be a history museum or a special collections like ours, or even call a local historian. And those people that do are the ones that save history. For the rest of us.
That is it. Like I said, I'm still floored at this idea, at this story. But you know, I mean, I've read about things like this, and you're right. It's the least likely place you think you'd find something. I'm talking with Christina Favretto, head of Special Collections at the University of Miami Libraries. We're talking about the original Henry Flagler Railway to Key West blueprints, which are at the UM Library and available for viewing. This is part of our conversation for the Sundial Book Club, as we are reading The Last Train to Paradise by Les Standiford for January, and it's the story of the effort to build the railroad to Key West and how it changed South Florida forever. Christina, when you look at going back and looking at those blueprints, what's one thing that really jumped out at you?
It's the scope of the project. This scattering of little islands in the ocean, and to think of linking them with something, they look so delicate when you look at them on a map, and to think of linking them with something as heavy as a railroad is just, it's visually very arresting. You know, you just look at it and think, people think big thoughts and big projects and they make them happen. And that's always astonishing to me.
When you know, people can come and see them, but you have to do it a certain way, right? How do you present these? If I wanted to come see them, how would you present them? And you know, again, to protect them, but give people the chance to see them.
Well, I should premise that with saying that people are always amazed that they get to touch stuff. And what the comment I get most often is, I'm looking at this book that's 400 years old. You're not making me wear gloves. And I say to that, well, if you wear those cotton gloves, they actually reduce the sensitivity of your fingers. As long as your hands are clean, you can turn the pages of a book and not do damage. But blueprints are another story. You have to wear the white gloves. Mm. So you would come in and we would have the blueprints. The big one would be unrolled. We would have these very specially made weights that weigh down the various parts of the map so it can be flat on a long table. And the other blueprints, the smaller ones, you just lay them out. And we would ask you to wear your white gloves. But beyond that, you're allowed to very delicately handle them.
We watch you carefully.
But we want people to have the experience of interacting with these materials.
I'd imagine, though, at some point, especially when you're talking about books or maps, anything with paper, that over time, at some point, there has to be another level of protection, because doesn't time eventually just eat away at materials?
It certainly does. It does. And for that reason, we make sure that we put materials in acid-free boxes. We maintain the humidity, and temperature control is what's most important. A lot of people who love books often think that they're doing something, and they're doing it from the right place. They want to put materials behind glass, but what you're creating then is a little glass, like a little warming area. And you're actually trapping in a lot of heat. So books need, they need clean air circulating around them. They need to be at the same temperature and humidity, and they need darkness, actually. So if you have really precious books, you'll notice how the spines of your books over time, even over a couple of months, if you leave them in the sun, especially South Florida, they will be a different color than the rest of the book. So imagine blueprints are much, much more delicate, by the way.
I guess I'm one of those people. I love old historical artifacts, but I almost treat it like Indiana Jones would. I barely want to touch it because I don't want to do anything to it. You know what? You have a fascinating collection of things. Going through the website, tell me about two of your favorites, because I know you have so many wonderful things.
So some of the are my favorites personally are materials that you wouldn't think of as rare, but they're going to be rare. They're going to be materials that no one saved. So it's not a single item, but it's a collection of zines, which are fanzines. And these are materials, the ones that I'm thinking of were actually mimeographed, done in the 1930s and 40s, and they're fan fiction. Even though I'm not a huge science fiction fan, they're really fun because they're done by people who loved superheroes. The ones I'm thinking of are women writing about women superheroes in the 1940s. So that's something that's actually quite, quite rare. It's as rare as a rare book, because that's not the kind of thing people tend to save. Mm. And then the other item is indeed rare, and it's a beautiful illuminated prayer book that used to belong to William Randolph Hearst. And it's one of a kind, of course, and it was done for probably a very wealthy person. So the beautiful little paintings inside, it's a small book probably owned by a woman, and it's a collection of prayers to be said at different times of the day. It's a beautiful object. It's bound very beautifully, and its history is really interesting. Mm. And those are things that we have in our collection and that people can just spend time with and look through.
And again, that was Christina Favretto, head of special collections at the University of Miami. And you can learn more about their collection and how you can go and see a lot of this stuff for yourself on our Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. Sign me up. I am ready to go over there right now. Well, that's our program for this Tuesday, January 25th, 2022. Katie Munoz is our lead producer. Leslie Ovalle is our producer and social media editor. Our engagement editor is Katie Lepre. Our news director is Taryn Shepherd. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. And Jessica Bakeman is our senior news editor. WLRN's interim program director and technical supervisor is Peter J. Meritz. Don't forget, the theme music for the show comes from the Miami Afro-Cuban funk band Palo at gopalo.com. If you missed any of the program, you can catch the rebroadcast tonight at 8. Or if you want to listen on your own time, we are a podcast. Find us on your podcast app, download it, WLRN Sundial, subscribe, and don't forget, rate us. Give us a little rating, a little review. Always helpful. Really do appreciate it. Well, coming up tomorrow on the show, Florida's pie is key lime, but there is an effort in Tallahassee to change it to the strawberry shortcake. I know, I can already hear the anger growing right now inside of you. Why the change, and what will it mean for key lime fans if it does change? More on that conversation coming up tomorrow. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thank you so much for listening. Stay safe. Take care of each other. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute.
WLRN Public Media.